So we're finally getting to the good stuff, which is applications to physics and gauge theory. Before we do that, I want to show you an example of a principal bundle. Just so that we have something concrete that fits the definition that we gave last time. And that will be the frame bundle. We can construct a frame bundle out of a manifold M. It's something connected to tangent vectors. Remember, we talked about frames that are sections of the tangent bundle that at each point form a basis. And the idea of the frame bundle is that we're going to put all possible bases at each point, and that's going to be our fiber. So we're going to build it like this. Fm is going to be the union for all the points in our manifold of the singleton of the point times some spacer I'm going to define in a second, and I'm going to call FAM. So it kind of looks like the way we define the tangent bundle by attaching at each point a copy of something. And these are all disjoint unions because the first thing is going to be different for each one of them, so they are disjoint union of pieces. And this FAM is the set of all n tuples of vectors in TAM to the n, and here n is the dimension of the manifold, such that V1 to Vn are linearly independent. So essentially, I'm attaching to each point all possible bases of the tangent space at that point. And the projector map from a point A, V1 to Vn, Fm, to M is just going to be take the first coordinate, ignore everything else. So pretty much the same kind of thing we do with the tangent bundle. The only difference is that instead of attaching the tangent bundle, we're attaching n vectors taken from the tangent bundle that form a basis. Now, the reason why we're doing this is that because it's a fiber bundle, I need to tell you what the fiber is. I'm going to take as fiber GL and R, and I'm going to take as a structure group also GL and R. So to see where this is coming from, I need to give you the trivializations so we can check that they are actually given by clutching functions that live in this space and act on this space in the usual way. For the trivializations, we're going to use charts on our manifold. So suppose that u x1 to xn v y1 to yn are charts for our manifold. This one we'll need later. For now, I'll just concentrate on the first one. To this, we can associate a trivialization. Phi that takes an element A. And now, because I want to write these vectors in terms of our coordinate charts, these are vectors living TAM, each one of them, which means I can write them as a linear combination of vectors of the R coordinate chart vector d over dx mu. So I can do something like this. I have A, alpha 1 d over dx alpha at point A. And this thing is a linear combination of these vectors, so it's a vector itself. And then next I'm going to have some other vector. I'm going to call this A alpha 2 d over dx alpha at A, all the way to A alpha n d over dx alpha at A. So each one of these things is a linear combination. I'm putting this information in this object, which ends up being a matrix, because it has n by n indices. And the first one here is going to have n remaining indices, and that linear combination, and then so on. So this is going to live in pi to the minus 1 of u. And to this, we're going to associate simply a point and capital A, the whole matrix, and this lives in U times GL and R. The reason why it lives in GL and R is that these vectors form a basis, which means that if you look at this matrix as the change of matrix from R coordinate basis to the V1 to Vn basis, they must be invertible, so it's in GL and R. So simply by the fact that these things are linearly independent, you end up with the fact that the matrix A that represents them is linearly independent. And this map is invertible because if I give you an invertible matrix, you can use that from a basis to build up another basis. And similarly, if I want to define something for the other chart, I'm going to define psi. Now it takes A, I'm just give it a different name so we don't get confused. Let's call it this B1 alpha D over DY alpha at A, all the way to B alpha N D over DY alpha at A. So this one is going to actually map to A, B. So it's pretty much the same idea. We're going to take the components, but the matrix that changes the coordinate basis into the basis vector, the basis that we are associating at point A, and we just take the matrix as a representation. So these form local trivializations, and then if you want to look at how they transform into each other, we need to look at the transition maps. So if you look at psi composed phi to the minus 1, this is now going to be defined on the intersection of U and V. So if we take AA in U intersection V times GL and R, what's going to happen? The first thing we do is apply phi to the minus 1. So we have phi of, and then we have, it's probably easier if I just write this separately. So first thing to notice is that psi to the minus 1 of A capital A, we just follow this in reverse, is going to be the point A, and then we're going to have A1 alpha D over dy alpha at A, so that's simply the inverse of the trivialization that I gave before. And now if you want to apply phi on it, I need to rewrite this in terms of the d over dx basis. So this is going to be A, and we got A1 alpha. And now we can write this using the Jacobian as dx beta over dy alpha at point A, d over dx beta, and all the way here. So now if you apply phi to this, we are taking these things as the matrices. But these matrices, if I define the matrix dx over dy, the whole Jacobian matrix, and I say that the alpha beta entry, so alpha is going to be the rows, beta the column, is just dx alpha over dy beta, then this is like doing dx over dy times the matrix A. So when we do that, we end up with A dx over dy at A times A in U intersection V times GL and R. So a clutching function, to call it TUV, to know this is the one between these two charts, that goes from U, takes a point A, U intersection V, and maps to GL and R, is simply this. And this is smooth. And the Jacobian matrix, because it's a change of charts, is invertible. The inverse will be dy over dx. So this does live in GL and R. And it acts on GL and R just by multiplication on the left, as we expected. So this is the multiplication on the left of the clutching function on the fiber element, and the fiber is the group G itself. So this fits into the definition that we had, where the charts I gave you form a G atlas. So the structure group is indeed what we expect, and everything turns up exactly like we wanted. And the last thing to say is that, as we mentioned last time, because this is a principal bundle, there is an action of the group on the actual bundle itself. The action of GL and R on FM is given by this. It's not difficult to check by just using the definitions like we saw last time. We take the point A, V1, Vn, and we map these two. If you want to act with it with an element G of GL and R, this is just going to be the point A is invariant because it should leave fibers invariant. And then we just take V1 and multiply by the right from J as a matrix. Sorry, that's not actually what we're doing. What we're doing is, that wouldn't work. We take the whole V1, V2, Vn. If you think of these as column vectors, then you can put them in this matrix, and now this is going to be a matrix, and you multiply the whole thing from the right by J. This is the one that makes sense. So this will be, in a sense, a column of vectors that live in. It's a weird matrix. It has numbers in one direction and other things in another direction, but this is more of a symbolic thing in which you understand how to act on these things using matrix multiplication. Is the example clear? This is mostly just to show you that there is something concrete that behaves like this. At this stage, we don't need this, although we may actually talk about something that's related to gauge theory that can happen here. So you can use the same language that we're using for gauge theory to talk about the usual covariant derivative from general relativity. You just put everything in the same framework as we're about to do for gauge fields, and you have to use the frame bundle as your starting point. Okay, so now that we have the example, we can finally start to talk about gear theory. So as I said last time, principal bundles are the framework in which gear theory works. But principal bundles on their own are not enough. We need some extra structure on a principal bundle for gear theory to work. This extra structure is called the connection. So let me define what this thing is. So suppose that pi p2m is a principal G bundle. A connection on P is a Lie algebra of G valued. Now, this is my best attempt at doing a fracture font. Hopefully, it's going to be clear that it's some kind of fracture G. So this will be the Lie algebra of G, if you prefer to write it in the form. So G valued one form. We call it omega. It lives in the space that I'm going to note by this. This is the space of one forms on P that have values on the Lie algebra G. Before I give you the extra properties, when I say that it is valued in the Lie algebra, there are a few ways of explaining what this is. Because I'm always going to assume in this course that the Lie groups are matrixly groups, this means that this factor is G valued, omega is a matrix of one forms. So you can think of it this way rather than thinking of something which is valued in something else. Just because this is a set of matrices, you can just think of omega as being itself a matrix. Each element of the matrix is a one form. It's kind of the same as when you think of a vector function as a vector of scalar functions. It's exactly the same idea. So such a form must satisfy two properties to be called a connection. If RG is the map that takes a point P in the bundle and maps it to G acting on P, still in the bundle, then if you do the pullback through this map of omega, this should be g to the minus 1 times omega times g. This is essentially telling us how omega transforms when we move all the points in the bundle by shifting them around, acting with g from the right. And the other requirement is this. If xi is an element of the Lie algebra, and x xi is a vector field on P, defined in this way, when I act with x xi on a function and evaluate at point P, this is going to be d over dt of f of p on which you act with e to the t psi at t equals 0. We saw something like this when we saw infinitesimal actions on, when we have an action of group and we look at the infinitesimal action. This is the same idea. X psi will be the vector field that represents the infinitesimal action of the group from the right on a manifold, and that's going to be associated to a Lie algebra element. So if this is the vector field, then omega, when it acts on such a vector field, spits out psi. Because omega is Lie algebra valued, so it can actually give us psi as the output. Now, at this stage, these requirements are a bit weird. We don't have time to go through the whole reason why this thing makes sense. So you kind of need to take them as is. We're not actually going to use these properties directly, but I just wanted you to know the full story. And something to note is that if the manifold M is nice enough, and here nice enough, if you're interested, means it's paracompact, then there always is such a thing. If P is a bundle over your manifold, you can always find a one form that satisfies these properties. So for all cases of interest to us, you can always find this. You need to come up with very weird manifolds for this to fail. M should be paracompact. Because it has to do with the charts on M. When you define things locally, you define things locally on M, and then you take that set and you pull it back up on P. Okay, so it turns out that this omega form that I just gave you encodes all the information about your gauge theory. But it's not very helpful right now, because if you want to think of this as a field, omega is a field. It takes values in P and is going to map them to something else. And the something else is going to be T star, if you want to be precise, this is not important, but it's going to be T star P tensor product with G. Now, we don't really care about this. The important thing is that this is not something we can interpret as a field on a manifold. If your manifold is spacetime, then you build a bundle over it, because I told you that you had to build a bundle to do gauge theory. Then you look at this form, and this is not a field that lives on spacetime. It does not associate at each point of space-time something. It associates at each point in the bundle something. So that's not very helpful. So we would like instead to get something that's a field on the manifold. To do that, we're going to need to review what sections of a bundle are. I very briefly mentioned this when we talked about the tangent space and cotangent space and so on, to talk about vector fields. But I'll just redefine everything so we know. A section of a bundle pi to m. This is just a fiber bundle. It does not need to have any extra structure. Is a smooth map, what we call it X, that goes from some open subset of the manifold to E, such that X of A belongs to the fiber at A. So we just want to make sure that this map goes through the fibers as we move the points. So if you think the cylinder, for example, and you think of this as a collection of fibers which are just vertical lines, then something which is a section will do maybe something like this, and it can go around, but it can never go vertical, because you cannot stay on the same fiber as you move around. Every time you change your point, you need to change fiber. Equivalently, and I think this is how we wrote it last time, X composed with pi should be the identity map on you. So there's nothing weird about it. It's just that this way we can actually interpret this as a field on U, because at each point M in U is going to attach something in a fiber, but the fibers all look like the model fiber F. So this means that we are in a sense attaching a fiber element at each point in a smooth way. So that's a definition for all bundles, but for principal bundles, something interesting happens. And this is pretty much the reason why principal bundles are a good place to do gauge theory. In principal bundles, we can transform sections into each other. In the following way. If I had two sections, S equals from U to P, and S prime that also goes from U to P. Then I can map one into the other in the following way. Since the action of the group G on P is transitive on the fibers, and remember, this means that if two points P and Q belong to the same fiber, then there is a group element that sends P into Q. Now, because of this, S prime at a point U is going to look like S U on which we act with some group element, which is going to depend on you. And G is going to then be a map that goes from U to G, which is smooth. So we can always do this, and the smoothness comes from the fact that the action is smooth, so we can do this in a smooth way. So if I give you a section and a map that to each point associates a group element, then I can take this thing, act on the other section, and come up with a different section. This kind of thing, this map here, we're going to interpret as a group action. So this is actually going to be a gauge transformation. And this is the reason why we're using this as our framework, because it allows us to do these things. So keep this in mind, and we're going to see soon how this actually applies and why it gives you gauge fields. But this is really the important reason why we're doing this in the first place, why principal bundles are good for this. Any questions so far? So we're going to look at, because of this fact, we're going to look at some particular kinds of sections. So suppose that this is the global, the maximal G atlas of P. I can create some special sections that come from these trivializations. We define a section SI that takes a point P sorry, the section goes from the manifold. So it takes a point, let's call it small u in ui, and associates to this a point on the bundle. The way we do it through the trivialization is by taking phi I to the minus 1. And this is now a map that goes from ui times the fiber back to the principal bundle. And I'm just going to take the point u itself and the identity element of the group. So this lives in P. It's the most obvious thing I can do. There's only one special element of the group that's always defined for every group, and that's the identity. So if I need to pick a special one, that's the only one I can pick without making arbitrary choices. So this is a section. And now if I look at the intersection ui and uj, if this is non-empty, then I can look at how to write one in terms of the other. So sj, if I restrict it to elements in ui intersecting uj, this is going to map to phi j to the minus 1 of ue. But then I can use the transition functions, use the usual trick of writing this as phi I to the minus 1 of phi ij of ue. But phi ij of ue, because of the clutching functions, is the same as doing phi I to the minus 1 of u tij u, acting on the identity, which is just tij u. And then we remember the properties of the group action on P and the fact that these things are equivariant. And this is the same as doing phi I to the minus 1 u e, on which we act from the right with t I j u. So this ends up being just s I of u, on which we act with t I j. So as we saw before, you can transform one into the other. But now the cool thing is that this is the maximal atlas. This means that this contains all charts that can be mapped into one another by using clutching functions, all possible ones, which means these sections are actually all the possible sections. They're all in there. If there is another section, because it can be written by group transformation in terms of another one, there will be a compatible chart that you can put in here. But there's nothing else to add in here. This has everything you need. So this is helpful. That's why we talked about these maximal G-atlases, because now P with the atlas contains all possible sections. And as we'll see, if we interpret this as gauge transformations, it contains all gauge transformations. Now, as another thing, this means that, just as a consequence, P has a global trivialization that is trivial. It's not directly written as a product, because in general, it's not going to be exactly a product, but it's isomorphic to something trivial. If and only if P has a global section. Because sections are in one-to-one correspondence with trivializations. So if there is a global section, that will give you a global trivialization and vice versa. So this is important. This doesn't happen for general bundles. General bundles, for example, if you want to know if something's parallelizable, in n dimensions, you need to find n linearly independent global sections. But for a principal bundle, you just need to find one. If there is one, that's it. It's trivial. And it also tells you if it's not trivial, there are no global sections. You just can't. So this is a very important point to keep in mind for gauge theory. Is this point clear to everyone? OK, so now we can actually talk about gauge fields. So remember with the problem that, where did I write it? It's probably hidden at this point. Omega is the problem that it does not live on the manifold. But the way to make it live on the manifold is simply to define something that we're going to call AI, which is the pullback through the section I of omega. Now, because the pullback is something that goes from our manifold M to the bundle P, this is going to be something that lives now in omega 1 of U, which is a subset of M, and it's valued in the algebra. So these quantities here are physically going to be interpreted as local gauge fields. And this is the local gauge field fixed by the choice of gauge Si. So we're going to interpret the sections as fixing the gauge. And because one is transforming to another by just doing an action of the group at each point, and it could be different, then choosing another one will just mean changing everything by a group action at each point. So there will be physically what a gauge transformation is. So this is gauge dependent, because if I choose a different section, Sj, you are generally going to have a different format of this. And the way they transform is what you would expect by the things you've seen in actual gauge theories applied in physics. Is this idea clear?
So I'm not varying omega. I'm varying like gauge transformation is changing the SIs.
Yes. So this is an important thing. Omega is fixed.
Yeah.
You cannot really change omega. Once you find the equations of motion that fully specifies omega, so you find Maxwell's equations, that's going to fully specify omega. What's not specified is the local representation of it that depends on the section of the bundle that you've chosen. So you should think this way. You have a space which is fully invariant, which is P. But that's not the physical space. That's not where you can do things. If you want to work with things in an easier way, you need to use these things, but these rely on some arbitrary choice of a section. Because you can choose a section in whichever way you want, and there is no physical reason of choosing one over the other, that's a gauge symmetry. It's something which is only living in your theory, but it's not an actual physical thing. So think in electromagnetism, F is a gauge invariant thing that's perfectly well defined. You could work with that directly, but to make things easier, you work with A, which, however, depends on a random choice that you have to make. Yes?
Do transitions on the principal bundle correspond to gauge transformations as well, or are they only in the S?
Can you repeat the question?
So I know that I have I can make transitions in the principal bundle, and the omega transforms like G minus 1.
Yes.
G. Are those also gauge transformations, or are only the S, choice of S is like a gauge thing?
They are related to each other. There's really an isomorphism between groups or transformations. Because of the fact that we chose the maximal atlas, it doesn't really matter. So we don't have to actually transform omega. We can just think omega is fixed, and then the sections are going to give us all possible things. Or you could think that you have just some sections, and then by performing a global transformation on P, that changes also your sections, and it transforms things. This is a bit ambiguous in the literature, because depending on whether you're talking to a mathematician or a physicist, they're going to call gauge transformation a different thing. So for mathematicians, gauge things are usually on P, while for physicists, the gauge things are going to be on the manifold. So I'm using the physicist thing because you are in theoretical physics program. So whenever I say gauge stuff, it's on the manifold M. So sometimes you may find different way of saying things just because people call gauge transformations some other things. And sometimes they call physical gauge transformations these things. I don't like them because gauge transformations aren't physical. So it's not a very nice name. Okay, so because these quantities are gauge dependent, we want to see how they transform. So in the context that I'm setting up here, which is not the only way of doing this, so this relates to the question that I just had. In our context, a gauge transformation means we are choosing another section. We're not really transforming anything, just I choose another section, but also because of the fact that the sections are all related to each other by these group transformations at each point, you could think of a gauge transformation as being your section is fixed, but you transform it by acting with it at each point with the group. It's equivalent. So how the transform means how is aj, which is going to be sj star omega, relate to ai, which is si star omega, when ui intersection uj is non-empty. So if these two sections overlap, because they're different, if you choose one or the other, that's going to change the representation of your field. And physically, there's going to be a gauge transformation. So we want to know what happens to this. And the formula that you get is this. Aj is going to be G, Tij to the minus 1, Ai Tij plus Tij to the minus 1, D Tij. So this is the formula for the gauge transformations once you change gauge. Now, I'm not actually going to prove this. It's not super difficult, it's just very lengthy and annoying to prove, because I need to tell you a bunch of things about Lie groups and the algebras and tangent spaces or product spaces. I just want to take half an hour or more for no reason. This is just a consequence of the definition of omega, which is still somewhere here. Those two properties are exactly what make the transformation happen. So you're just using these two properties. It's just not an easy thing to prove. So I'm going to skip that. If you're interested in the proof of this thing, I put a reference to a book in the course outline. So you can look at that to find all this information. Yes?
So could you clarify the exterior derivative of Tij?
Yes. I'm going to explain what this means. I'm not going to prove it, but I'm going to explain exactly what this thing is, because it's a bit weird. So first of all, how do we actually read this? How do we multiply functions and these things? What is the inverse of this thing? I'm just going to make it clear. First of all, Tij to the minus 1 is the map that takes a point u and maps it to Tij u to the minus 1. So it's not really the inverse of a function. It's the function that maps to the inverse in the group of the original function. And really, the way this thing should be interpreted is if I take aj as a one form at a point u and I feed it a vector x, now this thing is an element of the Lie algebra because I took away all the other things that matter. Otherwise, that's a one form, it depends on a point, and at each point you feed it a vector. So this should be tij of u to the minus 1 times ai at point u, you feed it x, times tij u, plus tij to the minus 1 at u. The minus 1 goes after. And now that dtij is going to be dtij at a, where you feed at u, and you feed it x. Now this thing here, this dtij, we are thinking of this as a G valued, or I guess matrix valued one form. So the way we think of how do we do D of a map that has values in the matrix, it's a matrix, you just do it component by component. So just think of Tij is a matrix of scalar functions. So Tij, matrix of scalar functions. And so DTij is a matrix of exterior derivative of scalar functions. So they are all one forms. This is trickier to think about when the group is not a matrix of the group, but in our case, you just assume it's a matrix of the group, it makes things a lot simpler. So that's how you think about it. So as I said, I'm not going to prove this transformation law. There is one thing that I want to prove because it's not obvious at all, and that this thing is still a G-valued one form. This part is easy because if I have the inverse of a group element acting on a Lie algebra element, and then you act with the group element on the right, this is still in the group element. This is the adjoint action of the group on the Lie algebra element. You can just do this by looking at exponentials using the series form. This is less obvious. The fact that if I take the exterior derivative of this function and multiply by the inverse, I get something in the Lie algebra. So this thing I'm going to show you just to make sure that it makes any sense at all. And now this thing there is the way that gauge fields transform. So this is what we should expect from gauge fields. This is the full way that they transform if you're working with a non-abelian group. If you're working with an abelian group, then A lives in the Lie algebra, but this action, because it's abelian, actually ends up taking Tij times Tij, they just cancel out, and you end up with Ai in the first place. And so you're only left with this. So when you look at abelian group actions, you're only going to have the part on the right, but more generally, this is the way they transform. And before I prove this thing, just because I want to make sure I have time to tell you, the important thing about this construction, and also the reason why we're going to do things in a certain way in physics, is that while it's obvious that if I have omega, I can define AIs, so I can define all of the AIs, and because the sections are all possible sections, I define all possible kinds of gauge fields, the construction goes both ways. If I give you a set of fields AI that live in here, so they are G-valued one forms on your manifold, and I require that they transform like this on the intersections ui, uj of the trivializations, then they actually define uniquely omega, the connection on the principal bundle. So you can go both ways. You can do the big picture on the principal bundle, and then you take it down to the manifold to do calculations. Or you can directly define things on the manifold, and that automatically gives you the principal bundle. In fact, if I tell you all these things and I tell you the clutching functions, this is, again, something I have not proven yet, probably do it at some point in the last two lectures, but you can build the principal bundle, the actual manifold, out of the clutching functions. So in practice, in physics, what you do is, you just tell me what your manifold spacetime is, then you give me the gauge fields locally, tell me how the clutching functions works, which means tell me if the bundle is trivial or if you have different patches that transform with the gauge transformation. And then the whole construction from principal bundle actually comes directly from here. You don't have to do it by hand. Which is great because it allows us to work with the things that we know from physics, but still have the mathematical framework that tells us important things about this stuff. Okay, so proof of this thing. So proposition. So suppose that G from U in M to G is a smooth map. Now, I want to show that g to the minus 1 dg is something that lives in here. So to do this, first we need to review something. So because G is a matrix Lie group, then because they're matrices, we don't need to worry about differential geometry to define tangent spaces. We can just look at derivatives of matrices by doing component-wise derivatives. So this means that the Lie algebra can actually be seen as this. It's going to be the set of all gamma dot zero such that gamma is a curve in the group, which is smooth, and that passes through the identity at parameter zero. So this is the same idea as doing tangent spaces in terms of curves rather than derivations, but also because G lives in a matrix space, we don't need to add charts to it and look at the equivalence classes and all that stuff. You can just actually take these things because these are elements that live in a matrix space. So this is component-wise derivation. So again, just think of this curve as being a matrix of scalar curves. And then you can just take derivatives one by one. This thing is not an obvious thing, but we're not really doing things about Lie groups here. This is not the way you will define the Lie algebra of a matrix Lie group, but it is equivalent, and it follows from the property of this, the exponential map. So once we know this, we can prove this thing. So now let x that goes from u to tm be a vector field. Then to check that the thing lives in G, we need to do g to the minus 1 dg. We feed the vector field to the one form, and then we evaluate the whole thing at some point u, so that nothing else is there, and this should just be an element of the Lie algebra. So first of all, because this is a function times a one form, this is the same as evaluating the function at the point u, and then the one form will just be dg at u, and then we feed it x at u. And this is the same as doing x u acting on the function g. You can just check these in coordinates to see that they're the same thing. But we don't need coordinates if you want to do this thing abstractly. Now, to do the next step, I need an extra piece of information. Because x is a vector field, it has a unique integral curve. So that gamma that goes from minus epsilon to u be the unique integral curve of x with gamma of 0 equals u. You can always do this because I'm setting up an ordinary differential equation. I'm saying that gamma dot t equals x at gamma t with gamma 0 equal u. And because x is a smooth vector field, this always has a solution and it's unique. Now, because of that, acting with this is the same as acting with g u to the minus 1. That will be the same as doing gamma dot at 0 acting on g. Because gamma dot 0 will be x at gamma of 0, but that's our point u. And the way this thing is defined gamma dot 0 acting on a function is going to be the function composed with gamma derived and evaluated at 0. Just the way this works as a derivation. So this is g u to the minus 1. The multiplies g composed gamma prime at 0. So finally, this is d over dt. Now this does not depend on t, so I can just bring it inside the derivation. So I have g u to the minus 1 times g of gamma of t evaluated at t equals 0. And now this thing here, you can think of as a curve that goes from minus epsilon to epsilon to the group. So this is a curve on the group. It's smooth because it's composed out of smooth things. And at t equals 0 gives you the identity. Because at t equals 0, you get g of gamma of 0, which is u, times g u to the minus 1, and you get the identity. So this is something that lives in here. And so indeed, you get a group, the algebra element out of it. And this last step is why you need to multiply by g to the minus 1. If you just did, if you just did dg, this will not be a Lie algebra element in general. Because if you do this, you end up with this, and then you end up with g of mu, which is not the identity in general. And so they will not actually live in the Lie algebra, it will live in the tangent space at a different point. So it will not be the Lie algebra of your manifold. So that g to the minus 1 is very important. In this combination, it works. If you remove the g to the minus 1, it doesn't work. Yes?
So like, how do we write locally like this A? Because it's Lie algebra valid, right?
Yes. So if you want to write it locally, you will write it as a matrix.
Okay.
So you can do this in a couple of ways. Good question, though. So the question is, how do we write it locally? So one thing they usually do is you take a basis of the Lie algebra. Mm-hmm. So suppose this is a basis of G. So if G is n-dimensional, you have n of these things, they're linearly independent, it doesn't matter what they are. And then your local A is going to be written as this. And when you write it like this, now this actually is simply one form.
Yeah. And the Z one form acts on the vector field, right? Okay.
Yes. So the one form part is the thing that acts on the vector field, and the other thing is just an element of the Lie algebra, it doesn't care. So you can write it in components. That's usually what you end up doing when you're doing quantum field theory anyway. Or you could just think of it as a matrix. Instead of writing it like this, for SU2, for example, you just think of SU2, you have a basis for the Lie algebra of SU2, yeah. And then you just write it as a basis that has components in here. That's probably a bit more annoying anyway. And then, of course, this thing itself, you can write in coordinates. So if you wanted to, you could then take this and write it as a mu,
yeah,
dx mu ta.
Yeah.
So you have a few things happening here. There are two structures. Yes?
Do we always take a in the adjoint, or do we also take other representations?
It's always going to be the adjoint because the way we're doing things is with the principal bundle. So the action of G on itself is the thing that gives you the adjoint action on the Lie algebra. So it doesn't make sense to use some different action because that would kind of break the way we're working. That said, if we have time, I'm going to also tell you about how to act on matter fields. And if you do that, then you can take any kind of action that you want. So that's once you have this whole framework, and that's one of the useful things of using principal bundles, you can associate to the principal bundles other bundles. So you can decide to act on some other fields that may describe your matter fields, and you decide in which way the group acts on them. So then it's up to you to decide which kind of action you want.
So covariant derivative cannot be defined now, like we need an additional structure.
Yes. Although you can define a derivative on P itself. You can define a covariant derivative on the bundle P itself. So you can define a derivative now. It's not very helpful. But you could. But usually you want that the covariant derivative is useful
to add vector space.
Yes. But it's actually still useful even here, because when you want to talk about the equations for your field, for the strength, you will write something like dAf equals 0. And this is the covariant derivative on the bundle itself. But we will talk about that later.